This is the second of a two-part interview with Richard Leitner, journalist with the Brabant chain, Michener Award winner for his coverage of the Taro dump in Hamilton, Ontario. How did the Fifth Estate get interested in the story?
The Fifth Estate got involved through a freelance writer, Paul Polango, who used to work at the Globe and Mail and has done several books, including an expose on the RCMP. He read about Phillips' decision to sue Michael Hilson for $35 million for writing a letter to the Minister of Environment expressing concerns about the Taro dump and the potential that hazardous waste might wind up at that site. To him, the figure just struck him as tremendous, you know, a sledgehammer to kill a fly. And he thought, you know, it was suspicious, so he started digging around. And actually, the first time I met him, I was somewhat suspicious of Paul because the company just was taking a very heavy-handed approach to critics, and I wondered whether Paul had been hired to get me to say something slanderous against the company so they could find a way to get me off the story. Shortly after that, sort of a bigger Fifth Estate team arrived. I knew one of the researchers, Harvey Cashore, who's gone on to become a producer with the CBC, exceptional journalist. And so they started probing the story, and they ultimately did a story in, I believe it was late February 1996, on the dump, which essentially reported the conflict as we had reported in the Stony Creek News over the previous 2 or 3 years.
I understand you received some threatening phone calls.
Phillip was not a company to fool around with, that they were serious and they were determined to get their dump. Did meet Alan Fracassi on a couple of occasions. He was the chief executive officer of Phillips, and his brother was a vice president. He showed up at one public meeting in Upper Stony Creek, sort of just going around and not really talking to residents. Phillip had a community appreciation night that they held at the Leona Gardens in Winona. And this coincided actually with the formation of SCRAP, which was the Stony Creek Residents Against Pollution formed to fight the dump. Dominic Agostino, the former Hamilton East MPP, and Terry Cook were sort of slavish in their praise for Phillip and for Fracassi. Cook waxed on about, you know, private-public partnerships and how that was Hamilton's future. That was sort of my only dealings with Alan Fracassi.
What about the $35,000 under-the-table deal?
Victor Verri was sort of, considered sort of a local watchdog, a bit of a self-styled local watchdog who had run on a number of occasions for Stony Creek Council, unsuccessfully, although he did challenge Larry Deanney and came within a reasonable number of votes to beating Deanney, but Deanney hung on there. I think it was something like 1,500 to 1,000. It wasn't a huge voter turnout. He had looked into the zoning of the East Quarry site, and Stony Creek Council had rezoned the site without proper public notice to allow for the dump uses. And it had also put holding designations on the surrounding land, which affected a farmer, as well as some business owners, and a number of property owners who very likely were speculators. So Verri challenged that before the Ontario Municipal Board. Even though he had missed the deadline for doing so, the Municipal Board made the unusual move of allowing for a hearing to look into that matter. And Verri had solicited funds, my understanding from people that I talked to, from some of the neighbors to do so. And SCRAP was also interested in being a party to that hearing. Just shortly before that hearing was about to begin, I think about a day or two beforehand, Verri suddenly announced that he wasn't going to proceed with the hearing. And Phillip said that it was making a contribution to his expenses, because it thought that he had genuinely been interested in, you know, a public issue that essentially he was looking after the public interest. That's the way it was characterized. Verri would not comment on the deal, citing basically a confidentiality agreement as part of the settlement. After that, I had heard that in fact, Very had received a secret contract from Philip as part of this payout. Although he was talking about it to some people, he wouldn't go publicly to any reporter. So I called him in one day to the Stony Creek office, and we spent probably 8 hours in a room talking about this. And, you know, I kept on trying to get him to go public with the story. And he said, no, you know, first of all, there are a couple of concerns. One was the confidentiality agreement, but I think he was genuinely frightened of Philip and what might happen. So I told him basically, look, Victor, I've got enough information to go with that. I'm going to go with the story, which, you know, I have to admit was a complete bluff, because, you know, here you have a company that's been suing people left, right, and center, you know, to do a story where potentially the source might deny it would be probably not well advised. However, he did sort of, I think he wanted to come clean, so he found a way to get around the confidentiality agreement, which was to have one of his friends confirm it for me, and then I approached him and we did the interview. So he acknowledged the deal, which was essentially that he received, I believe it was $35,000 in money for expenses, and then this separate contract that was $11,000 a year as a consultant, a subsidiary of Philip. The company had denied that it had done anything like this, both at the time of, you know, when Very withdrew his OMB appeal, but also on national TV to the Fifth Estate. Their lawyer, Herman Terkstra, said that, you know, nope, Victor didn't receive any extra money. This was just, you know, they were helping him. They realized that, you know, he was probably well-intentioned and that they were helping defray his expenses. Well, when I talked to the neighbors who were helping him pay for the OMB challenge, they said that, you know, the week of that hearing, they were told that his expenses had been about $4,000 to $5,000. So how you got from $4,000 to $5,000 to $35,000, and then this side contract, Victor, when I asked him, so what are you doing for this $11,000 a year? And he said, well, I haven't done anything yet, but it's consulting, you know. If they need me, I'm here. If they don't, you know, I don't think he was expected to do anything for that money. And to my knowledge, he never did do anything for that money. I believe Philip objected to the payments after that. This is before the approval of the dump. It's actually right after the Fifth Estate story ran, because the Fifth Estate asked about the Very deal and the company denied that there was anything untoward there. So this would have been, you know, I guess March of 1996, and the dump was approved in July of 1996. So certainly from my perspective, what it showed was a complete corruption of the public process. I mean, here you had Stony Creek Council that rezoned the site without proper public notification. A citizen in the public interest challenges that decision. The company comes to the table and pays this person off with an under-the-table contract. And how any public official can support that as a process is beyond me. Anne Bain, when I called her at the time, basically washed her hands of it and said, you know, big companies do things like that all the time, which, you know, hopefully they don't. Maybe there are some that do, but, you know, I think it's highly unethical behavior, and it's highly unethical for any politician to accept that as accepted behavior.
Maybe there was nothing she could do.
She could have done plenty about it. She had a key vote in that decision. The province repeatedly told Stony Creek that, you know, its vote was critical to the process. And council, time after time, voted 5-4 in favor of Philip. What the minister told the council was, I'm going to approve this unless there are public hearings. So that allowed Stony Creek to say, look, we oppose this. But they didn't want public hearings, so by extension, the dump was going to be approved. In fact, Herman Terkstra went around to a variety of commenting agencies and said, say anything you want about the proposal, criticize it, but please don't ask for a public hearing, because he knew what the end game was. This was going to be approved unless there were public hearings. Had it gone to a public hearing, it would have been rejected. There is no question in my mind. The Nygaard-Escarpment Commission, their lawyer stood up, and they ultimately decided not to ask for public hearings because the Harris government had slashed their budget by 40%, and they said they couldn't afford to fight a hearing. Having gone through the Steatley hearings, which were 120 days, an expensive process. So their lawyer stood up and said, look, these projects are virtually identical. Same types of sites, same concerns. The minister has all the information she needs to reject the proposal. We can't afford to go to a hearing. The city of Stony Creek had plenty of opportunities to stop this dump. And time again, they voted 5-4. And Anne Bain, every time, was one of those five, which also included Larry Deanney and Maria Pearson, who are currently members of Hamilton City Council, as well as John Santorelli, former councillor, and John Copland, who was a long-serving councillor. So they sort of consistently voted in favor of Philip. That effectively thwarted the community's opposition. I mean, Scrap, I think, did a pretty good job in mounting the case for why the dump should have been rejected. It made several what I thought were pretty compelling submissions to the minister. A number of residents wrote in with their own submissions, and I believe they had Scrap had collected some 6,500 signatures showing opposed to the dump. The city of Stony Creek, ironically, after the approval of the dump, did some polling, and they were polling citizens on a variety of issues, and they left the whole taro issue off the questionnaire. But there was a portion where people could write in their comments, and there were many, many comments from across the city about the city's handling of the taro dump, and highly critical of council and the mayor. We managed to get a copy of that. The city obviously didn't want that released because it was highly embarrassing. It's very unusual for people who do a lengthy survey at the end of it, when you say any further written comments, to get into an issue in any extensive way. So, that really must reflect from his experience that people were agitated, because that's the other thing. The city tried to say, it's only just a couple people who are really worked up about it. Brad Clark, the Stony Creek News.
I'm curious about the UNESCO biosphere aspect of this that always conveniently seems to be getting ignored.
The Nygaard-Escarpment is one of, it's a fairly important designation, and essentially what it asks is that there be sustainable practices around. To give you an example, the Florida Everglades would be another example of a world biosphere. And the idea, my understanding of the biosphere, is not to prohibit development, but to ensure that it occurs in a way that is sustainable and takes into account, the significant landform that is being protected. Certainly, you'd think that putting a dump in a world biosphere would just be a no-brainer, that's just, should be forbidden. I think Philip successfully contained the political pressure because, apart from the Fifth Estate, the Stony Creek News was the only media organization that was covering this in any substantive way. So, yes, organizations became aware of the project, but there wasn't sort of, let's say, the massive attention of, let's say, when they start logging old growth forests in BC.
You want to talk about the $1 million lawsuit?
I had been threatened with lawsuits twice. The first occasion was part of the Michael Hilson legal action. The way Philip framed the suit was Michael Hilson, John Doe, Jane Doe, and others. So I was considered one of those others. And the essential allegation there was that we were conspiring to drive down Philip's stocks. And certainly news of the Hilson letter did drive down stocks temporarily, but they recovered. So as part of that, Herman Terkstra, alleged that I was, working with Hilson, who I had not even met or heard of at the time of the writing of the letter to drive down Phillips stocks. Just a ludicrous allegation, but it's one way of intimidating people and silencing them. And there was this injunction put on the Hilson letter, so you couldn't even report on it. And you couldn't talk to Mike Hilson, you know, extremely draconian injunction that essentially disappeared Mike Hilson. You'd have been breaking the injunction to interview Mike Hilson and ask him about his knowledge about Philip or the tarot dump, which, you know, outrageous. And that injunction continued for some 2 years. Now, people started breaking it. The Fifth Estate broke it, challenging it, and no legal action was taken. We chose because, you know, we had certainly a lot of pressure on us from every front. So the second time that I was threatened with legal action, or I guess my employer was, would have been in January 1996, I believe, late January, as the Fifth Estate was in town to do its first of two stories. It did a second story once after the dump was approved, and that revolved around some of the wastes that the site had received. However, this CBC was in town to do the first story, and one day, I'd written an editorial on the city's handling of compensation for the dump. Philip was proposing to give the city $10 million over 20 years, as well as, I believe it was $3 million for a sports park, in exchange, sort of royalties for accepting the dump. Sort of, here's a community trade-off. And, you know, certainly some counselors were very anxiously, I'd say five counselors, the five that always supported it, were very anxious to get that money. So I'd written a editorial criticizing council's belated decision to hold an open house on this compensation plan. It was basically a done deal, and then they said, we'll take it to the public. I think it was on a Thursday, and then we'll approve it on the Monday. And a reporter came up to me and said, John Young, our publisher, had ordered that all my Phillips stories, anything that I'd written, be pulled from the paper. And back then, we were physically pasting up our papers. We didn't have sort of the pagination system we now have. So that meant literally, you know, taking the stories off the page. So I went in to see him, and I said, you know, John, what's going on here? I understand that you're pulling all my tarot stuff. So he told me to close the door, and he pulled out this thick folder, and it had all these letters. And I gather that John Fisher, who is the tarot GM, had been writing our publisher regularly, raising concerns and asking questions about, you know, who was writing our editorials, which would be the, you know, the unsigned opinion of the paper. And John, to his credit, had dutifully said, look, the editorial is the position of the paper. We don't divulge who writes it because that's the opinion of the paper. And if you have a problem, deal with the paper. Don't, you know, go after the individual. The individual is taking a position as directed by the paper. However, his latest letter had was from Herman Turkster, the company's lawyer, and it drew some very bizarre connections to allege that we were conspiring against Philip. Anyways, this Turkster letter repeated his assertion that I was part of this conspiracy to drive down company stocks, and essentially stated that if I wrote another word about Philip, they intended to sue us for $1 million. So that explained my publisher's decision to pull my coverage for that week. So he made that decision. I guess what disturbed me about that conversation was, after going over the letter, you know, he said, you know, frankly, Richard, we're not sure that you don't have a hidden agenda, which was a shock to me because we discussed the story extensively over, you know, the, I guess, would have been at least the past year. And, you know, he said, frankly, you know, you're known to be somewhat of an environmentalist. Ian Thomas, who was involved in this debate, said, you know, what is an environmentalist? I mean, most people, environmentalists want clean water, clean air, and to leave that for their children and their children's children. And, you know, to sort of, you know, try and put a pejorative spin on that desire is it's a way of trying to, again, marginalize people who are concerned about something. So anyways, I basically went back to my desk and I fired off a letter, typed out a letter that I sent to the Southern president as well as to my publisher's boss, basically stating that, look, first of all, you know, my reporting, you know, stood for itself at no point. Were concerns raised about that, certainly by the company, but I guess more central to the point that, you know, sort of freedom of expression was something that I thought, you know, newspapers would stand by. I was back on the story within a week, and part of the reason is there was a public meeting, as it turned out, that week, held by Scrap, and obviously my being taken off the beat was a big topic, and people started calling the publisher, and I gather he got many calls because, you know, when I was put back on, he said, you know, you have a lot of friends. So I was put back on the beat, and I'd say I certainly learned something from that. It was truly a frightening experience to sort of, you know, when you're covering something and to be all of a sudden, you know, yanked off the beat. It's a chilling experience, but it certainly, you know, it didn't scare me off if that was, you know, the intent of the company. So I continued, you know, to report it for, you know, as long as I was on the Stony Creek News and aggressively. In fact, the Victor Verri story that I referenced earlier was, you know, one that I did after that. So, you know, if they thought that somehow that was going to deter me from pursuing the story, they were mistaken. If people go to the lengths that Philip did to try and get people not to look at their proposals, and, you know, it goes back to the central point that had this gone to a public hearing where people could have challenged Philip's proposal and shown the failings, it would have been rejected. I think Philip knew that, you know, because when the Hamilton Conservation Authority was the only agency that asked for a public hearing, Herman Turkster went there and, you know, berated people and said, you know, if you ask for a public hearing, what you're basically telling us is that you don't want us to be in this community. You know, he's sort of that economic threat that, you know, thousands of jobs would leave Hamilton. Nonetheless, you know, to its credit, and again, you know, the Hamilton Conservation Authority Board of Directors has a number of, or back then had, you know, a good mix of politicians. So you had Hamilton politicians who were supporting Philip and, you know, I mean, amazing for a conservation authority not to want public hearings when you think about it. But you had all these Hamilton politicians that trotted out all these tired analogies that, you know, made no sense, you know, comparing dump technology to brakes and things like that. Well, you know, brakes are a proven technology. We know how they work. It doesn't mean they can't malfunction, but it's a reliable technology as opposed to trying to overcome an unsuitable site. In this case, fractured limestone means you have to build a liner and then have all these contingencies in case it fails. And we're talking 300 years here. We're not talking a car that's, you know, 10 to 15 years in lifespan. The Conservation Authority, ultimately, it was a tie vote. And Alan Stacey, who was the chair of the Conservation Authority, got a second vote to break it. And he voted to ask for public hearings. And, you know, the Hamilton politicians were furious, including Marvin Kaplan, who wasn't even there the next day. And the Spectator sort of picked up on this spin that somehow that the meeting was illegal and there wasn't enough notice, which, you know, was not true. They all knew. In fact, the Spectator knew because it mentioned in it, you know, they had these briefs that the issue was going to go before the authority board that night. They didn't send a reporter, but they, you know, they let the public know that it was coming up, and then they did sort of the lazy thing, which is to follow up and then take the spin of a politician who wasn't even at the meeting. The CLC, well, there was a study group, which was comprised of some local residents that examined the project. And this was, you know, sort of the government saw this as another critical component of the approval process. And the idea was rather than have public hearings, have a study group of citizens, get citizens to look at it, and that presumably through that process, you might either change the project so it's more acceptable, or maybe those citizens will say, look, this is unacceptable and, you know, has to go to a hearing. Well, the problem with that process essentially is that although their meetings were open to the public, they were held at the Taro head offices in the small building. And I think a lot of people, first of all, didn't understand the importance of that study group to the overall process. So people didn't really pay attention to it. And if you go through their minutes, you know, they did hold monthly meetings. Philip used that process to steer things in its the direction it wanted. So for instance, first of all, the person who chaired it was the Taro GM. I mean, the Taro GM was the chair of this group, and you know, that in itself would direct discussion, and then they would trot in all their experts or so-called experts or consultants who would, you know, if there is an issue that people wanted to ask about, they'd bring in their consultant who would say everything was great. They had all these any contingencies worked out if the liner failed. The company members managed to dissuade the study group from inviting these people, and they always found all these excuses why they couldn't do it. But ultimately, it was a very closed process, and Anne Varangu, who was a resident who sort of, I'd say, was probably ground zero of opposition to the dump and declined an offer to sit on the study group, you know, she's likened it sort of to the Stockholm syndrome. The study group rejected the need for public hearings and actually got quite belligerent towards Scrap and people who were otherwise minded. It had negotiated a royalty deal. The study group put out a release right before the dump was approved that announced that it didn't see the need for public hearings and that it had negotiated a royalty deal that would pay it $10 million, same as the city of Stony Creek, $10 million over 20 years. However, I think something like $4 million of that would go toward the purchase of land in the area that was owned by Philip for the use of as a community park. So really, the money was not a lot when you think about it. I mean, you're actually looking at $6 million for a project that, you know, I'd say at the most conservative estimates would be worth at least $350 million in revenues. And it was well-timed for Philip because this was right before the project was approved. So I called one of the study group members who is listed as a contact, and I asked him about it. And, you know, he likened it to sort of, well, you know, we're going to trust that it's going to work. We don't know that, you know, the technology is going to work. And he likened it to battening down the hatches when a hurricane's coming, which I thought, you know, how, as a representative of the community, can you go out and say, look, we don't think this needs to go to a hearing, and then liken it to a hurricane coming? Given the approval process and the fact that there was a lot of anger in the community that there weren't public hearings, it's not surprising that people continue to watch Philip and the Taro operations very closely. This company did strike a community liaison committee, which was to provide oversight, and they certainly had their share of controversies in the first couple of years, including as part of the approval, Taro was required to pay for a full-time ministry inspector. Now, part of the problem in the way the approvals were written is it was silent on the hours of work for that inspector. So the community thought, well, why would you, you know, it's clearly an inspector while the dump's operating. Philip said, no, a part-time inspector, 24 hours a week. So there was this protracted argument about, you know, how long is how many hours this inspector should work, and whether it would be a ministry employee or whether it would be, you know, a private person hired by some third party. You know, the community was suspicious of, you know, having a third party provide the inspector, because, you know, Philip always seemed to, you know, always, you know, this 6 degrees of separation. It didn't often take very many degrees to link Philip and, you know, people that were so-called independents. In the ministry, you know, ironically, Hardy Wong, the ministry boss at the time, said, you know, he wanted to have a third-party inspector because he wanted to keep the long arm of the government away from this position, that he was worried that the Harris government would make cuts and then, you know, he'd have to cut staff. And, you know, just tells you a bit of the climate of for the Ministry of Environment. At any rate, you know, certainly over the years, we heard several stories about things that allegedly were going to the dump. And I'd certainly heard a variety of allegations that were sort of disturbing. But, you know, I kept on sort of pushing on some of the ancillary issues, like the decision to whether to allow the Taro dump to hook into the sewer system, which a big controversy in itself. And in September of 1998, I got a call from Brad Clark, who said he had somebody who worked at one of the Philip processing yards who wanted to talk to us about some of what Philip was doing. And so we met with this guy one summer night, and actually I met with him twice. And his stories were sort of fit very well with some of Michael Hilson's allegations about the EAF dust at this electric arc furnace dust, which is classified as hazardous. There were these giant stockpiles at the former Firestone plant, which Philip owned. And Hilson's allegation was that the company's plan all along was to send this stuff to the Taro dump. This employee, who told us some pretty disturbing tales as far as how Philip conducted itself. Some of the tales, like, you know, using sledgehammers to break open transformers that contain PCBs and things like that. And around that time, Mike Hilson and Paul Palango made a trip down to the Michigan Environmental Protection Agency to look at some documents to see what, that, you know, look into some of the stuff they're shipping up to Taro. So he looked at these documents, and it showed that they were sending all this stuff that appeared to be registered hazardous waste. And there are two types of hazardous wastes. There's sort of hazardous waste that what is hazardous and not hazardous is essentially the level of contamination. And there are some wastes that, even though they might be above the approved levels, they can be treated and disposed of at a non-hazardous site. But some of these wastes were wastes that are always considered hazardous, no matter whether they're treated or not. And in fact, if you do add something to them, like a binding agent, like cement, now that new waste is also considered hazardous. So they brought back these documents, and we had a meeting at Tony Skrika's office, and we sort of agreed to work together to try and nail down that story. Ultimately, out of that process, we ran with a story that was picked up by the Fifth Estate, that Philip had been importing all these, what was essentially cyanide wastes, adding cement and dumping them at Taro. And the ministry issued them a cease and desist order and said, you know, that this violated the law. That led to a lengthy process where, you know, the community wanted the dump closed, people wanted core sampling to see what other wastes were in there, because the ministry had an investigator look into this, and Philip had found a loophole in the law. Even though there was a manual that said you could not mix these wastes and put them in a non-hazardous site, that manual was not actually part of the law. It was sort of a manual that was an accepted practice, but hadn't actually been written into the actual regulation. So there was a loophole that you'd only know if, you know, you had people that were very familiar with that. And Philip had some high up former ministry people who would have been aware of that. They basically beat what was, you know, the charges on a technicality.